It's time for Valley Edition, a weekly panel discussion on current issues in the Mat-Su Valley, moderated by Mike Malevsky.
Well, folks, once again, it's time for another edition of Valley Edition. And I want to welcome into the studio, back after a short break, rest and recovery, Mark Kelsey. Welcome, Mark.
Good to be here, Mike.
And I also want to welcome into the studio, after a longer period of rest and whatever, Terry Snyder. Welcome, Terry.
Mark beat me in rest. I'm bummed already.
Okay. And on the phone, calling in because she's been here all this time, Zaz Hollander. Welcome, Zaz.
Hey, everybody. Good to be here.
Well, this obviously is a time when people are looking towards spring, and we're getting longer light. We've bumped the clocks around and all the rest of it, and there are some blue skies. But there's also been an incredible dump of snow recently, which has sort of accumulated in a very sneaky way. I say that because I have not moved a lot of snow this year until yesterday. And then I've noted from time to time there have been fluffy falls of snow and you just sort of brush them away. Well, yesterday I took a shovel and I put it into the snow and then I realized that the world has changed and the snow is no longer fluffy. It's very heavy and it was difficult to move. I'm not sure whether that's a metaphor for where we are at this time, but it seems to me that fluffiness in news has turned to be a little more heavy, if you will, as we get closer to such things as, well, take an example, as we get closer to the end of the time when a budget must be determined by the legislature and or its effect on the school board and the assembly and all the rest. But let's start with something that has been out there for a number of years. And I'm going to be talking about mass transit, and particularly commuter rail. And there's been a meeting recently, one meeting that was attended this past week by representatives from the cities of Wasilla and Palmer and Anchorage and, of course, the railroad. And it's very interesting what emerged from that. There was a report at the Palmer City Council meeting this last Tuesday and other conversations I've had that suggests that there is money in the budget, that is the state budget, that's been placed there by Governor Walker in the amount of, I believe, $4 million, looking toward planning and perhaps piloting of some form of rail transit between Anchorage and the Valley. The discussion about the specifics, though, seems to be a little bit unclear at the moment, with one exception. I believe that the city of Wasilla, led by its mayor, has been particularly interested in how this would work because they're in process of also looking for another location for the railroad station that they have there. And given the population in the valley and so on, having commuter rail that goes from Wasilla into Anchorage seems to make some sense. Zaz, do you have any other information than my brief summary about it?
Oh, I don't know if I have that much more information. There's another meeting of the task force March 30th at Wasilla City Hall. I think that's the second meeting of the task force that was convened after Governor Walker's kind of movement on this issue. And I think, that, you know, in general, kind of as usual, the feeling on, and my colleagues can probably speak more informatively to this, but I think most of us personally would like to see commuter rail. It would be a far easier way, at least, to get to Anchorage from the valley. But then immediately the questions start in terms of the, what, $300 million price tag, the how do you get anywhere from the train station. I remember, you know, trying to find bus routes to a potential job I was looking at and turned down the job because I couldn't figure out how to walk in winter the half mile in South Anchorage that I would need to that didn't have bus service. You know, there are infrastructure, huge infrastructure issues. But that said, you know, we also have a kind of a long legacy of rail projects. Some of them, when the late Senator Stevens was still alive, there's the depot at the fairgrounds that gets used when the fair is on, and then the with the Sheffield station at the airport. So there's certainly a past examples of a lot of money spent on rail projects that I guess could serve this one if it happens. But you know, in terms of a business plan, it certainly seems like it would be a subsidized commuter rail system.
Well, and the notion of subsidies, I think, is very much the key thing here. and it's raised as a negative. But I think, well, everything has cost. Everything comes with big expenses, including the Glenn Highway. And if we're going to continue to expand and reinforce and rebuild the Glenn Highway, that's a form of subsidy, too. You're using public cash to improve infrastructure. So I think part of what the charge of the commission now is to see if it's viable. It's not so much, you know, straight up, is it viable? It's, is it viable compared to the ongoing costs of maintaining and expanding the existing highway infrastructure? And I think that's where, if this is going to get any traction at all, the state and the railroad need to really fine-tune their messaging and not just present this as another run-of-the-mill infrastructure project. They need to talk about it in a way that means a lot to everybody and uses math to compare future costs of the highway with what it would be to get a commuter rail system going.
Mm-hmm. Terry?
That's absolutely true. That was basically going to be my remark. And I think that it's always going to be the same talking point, that it has to be subsidized. And I think Mark hit it in the nail on the head. We subsidize the roads all the time. We have to start somewhere. But I think the other thing that has to happen is Anchorage has to have a buy-in. I think if the Valley just pushes this, I don't see it going. But I think that Anchorage employers, which employ about a third of the Valley residents, and Anchorage itself has to see it as an asset coming into their community. And that, I think that alone, if South Central works together, something can become of it. Because you're right, that rail station at the airport, just the fact if I could go to the Palmer station here that we have at the fairground, leave my car and get on a rail that went right into Anchorage for my flight, I would be a happy girl. And I think a lot of people would be too. But now you get pushback from parking lots in Anchorage that get to get all that money from all the Valley vehicles that are stored there. So there's a lot of moving parts to this. But, you know, I'm glad that Governor Walker has put it on the table. But we should all be reminded that it's in his suggested budget to the legislature, and they can kill it in a heartbeat. And they make the decision on the checkbook. So whether they'll continue the effort, I know the railroad seems to be in favor, but it's good for them. They want to grow their infrastructure. We'll see if it stays in the budget to continue on. But I think there's just a lot of people that have to be educated and have to buy support in, or as Mark said, it just becomes another pie-in-the-sky infrastructure project. But at some point in time, we have to address the fastest-growing part of the Valley and options of getting there. And there was plenty of subsidies that was going to go for that bridge that everybody lost probably by a hair of not happening, and that wouldn't have served a great part of the Valley. So we have to start thinking as a whole here, as South Central.
I thought it was instructive at the Palmer City Council meeting. There were three people who spoke to this issue. Two of the council members pointed out that they worked in the J. Barrett Fort Rich area, and they tried to imagine how they would utilize this system to get there. And then the mayor, interestingly enough, also commented that she had recently driven into Anchorage and was successful because she was able to dodge the potholes on the highway. And again, mused, well, if the money is going there, is this coming from anything like the same pot that would maintain the highways that are used as well? So all of those issues are out there, and looking forward to a report from the second meeting and see just how this flows along. But it's an intriguing idea that has a passionate group of supporters, there's no doubt. Speaking about passion, there's passion involved with the Iditarod. And as we all know, and a Norwegian came in number one, and a Frenchman came in number two, and then Mitch Seavey upheld the Alaskan tradition by at least coming in number three. And there were 12 people who scratched from the race over time, including D.D. John Rowe. But most recently, there was a report of the first, I believe, dog death. I think it was in Koyuk. I know, Zaz, you had followed earlier questions about whether there would be opposition to the race from PETA and others. Anything at all bubbling up in that regard?
Well, yeah. I mean, as expected, this was, Mike, the first dog death we know about from Iditarod this year, and it was Catherine Keith's team. team, which stinks because for any number of reasons, she lost a dog to acute aspiration pneumonia in last year's Iditarod, which was one of five dogs that died. One of the other dogs was a dog that got loose in Anchorage, I believe after a restart, which was one of John Baker's dogs. The two of them are together. I think she's probably racing. I'm not in a loop on Iditarod this year, but I'm assuming she's racing some of his dogs since he decided not to take part in the race this year. And so it really is, you know, it's a tragedy for her and for the dog, obviously, but for the race, which is under a lot of scrutiny this year. And PETA did send out a press release. And, you know, I have to say to their credit, PETA almost always goes so far over the top that it's hard to take their messages seriously. But, and this one, you know, the same strong language and exaggerating facts. But their bottom point was, you know, the public deserves an accounting of what happens to these dogs, each one, you know, the cause of death in these dogs, but also all the dogs that have been dropped throughout the race. What happens to those dogs? And clearly they're not doing well enough to continue. It may just be a sprained ankle or a sore paw, but, you know, what happens with all those animals? And I'm certainly not saying there's something there, but the race has been not that responsive to smaller records requests in the past. So PETA did jump on that, and that's the cause of death in that dog. It was she dropped the dog for pneumonia symptoms, which isn't pneumonia like our pneumonia necessarily. It's normally linked to a dog inhaling something, whether it's its food or whatever, and then the lungs get inflamed because it goes down the wrong way. And the lungs get inflamed.
Right.
I think it should just be pointed out that I think maybe one of the things that Iditarod is suffering is trying to move over to a little more transparency in a lot of things. And they're getting a fair amount of criticism for that. So maybe there'll be some lessons learned here from the road they've been traveling on.
Well, let's shift focus a little bit. We have not spent a lot of time recently looking toward the legislature. We now have a legislature that is fully filled out. Everyone is there. We are getting ever closer to the end time, whenever that is going to be. Well, there's the budget. And we know that what's being floated in a variety of different ways is a question about just what to do with the permanent fund. Monies, how to do that, how to structure that, et cetera. But in addition, there are some other bills that are coming up that are being pushed in one way or the other. Terry, are you aware of any in particular that you see as gaining any traction other than that budget?
Well, I know one that's stuck and needs a little push, and that's the one I've been talking about for the last 5 years, the smoke-free workplace bill, SB 63. It's gone through the Senate twice. It's been kicking around the legislature for 5 years.
Has it really been 5 years?
Five years. It's has 88% of Alaskans, smokers and non-smokers, in support. There's thousands of businesses that are in support with resolutions. No good reason except now it's stuck in rules, blocked by one legislator, using it as a bargaining chip, pretty much like Aaron's Law was last year. It's just sort of a sad comment on democracy, I think, when that happens. Now, that said, if you go to the Alaska legislature page, you'll see there's a lot of bills trapped in rules, both in the House side and the Senate side. So you'll see the flurry at the end, whenever that is. I can't see how it's going to be at 90 days. I would think maybe by 120 days. But this should not be one of those things where good bills go to die when you have as many sponsors as you need, basically, on the bill to go to the floor, and it's just being held by one legislator as a bargaining chip. That's just a huge comment on the legislature, because there are people down there that are trying to do their job, but there's just too many people that are blocking things that need not be blocked on both sides.
And in this case, do you think it's being used as a bargaining chip?
I don't know. Hard to say. You know, that's inside baseball. You know, I think they all are that sit in rules at this time of year. And this one has had a lot of publicity. It's gotten press. AP reported on it last week. I mean,
it was in the national news.
Yeah. Yeah. So, that happened. That happened with Aaron's Law last year, too. Eventually, they did the right thing. But up to now, it's just there. So it's hard to say exactly what it is at this point in time. It could be some little bill. It might be a bigger thing. There's some frustration, and I think maybe it's, you know, justified on the House's side, because they've been putting bills out and churning out work where the Senate's been meeting and then not meeting and meeting about other things. But they're so far off on their goals. I just don't know how they come together. But on these things, this should be kicked out of the way right away. And they at least show that they've done something to the people of Alaska, for the people of Alaska. So that's my soapbox on one bill anyway.
Okay. Well, what I have picked up on is another bill, which has just recently, I believe, and you can tell me if I've got this correct, Terry. But there is a bill that I believe Representative Johnson has just been supporting, and it's being revised. And it has an interesting aspect to it in that it is a look at health aids that come into people's homes. And it has a focus because what we know is that under some payment plans, I believe Medicaid or Medicare, there are regulations that require
Medicaid
requires certification of those home health aides that come in and assist people who need help in their homes. But if you are not covered in that way, then it is somewhat of an unregulated industry. And there have been some complaints that individuals that are coming into the home are not therefore required to be trained, not paid very much, et cetera. Terry, you seem to know a little bit about
this.
Well,
it's HB 366 that Representative Johnson filed last minute, basically one of the last bills. And, you know, this is not an uncommon thing. Alaska is not an outlier in this. This is a big problem across the country of unregulation. And if you have Medicaid, Medicare doesn't pay for home care. VA pays for home care. Medicaid pays for home care. They're basically, you must go through an agency. But the agencies basically do little to no training to do it. And they are paid a substantial amount of money, although the healthcare workers don't reap the benefit of that. So there's definitely some work to be done there. I met with Representative Johnson when I was in Juneau last, and I think it's great that she's put it out there. I think she recognizes that the bill needs some work and that stakeholders need to come to the table and make her bill better. She's very open about that. But I'm quite happy that she started the conversation, because it's a conversation that needs to be had. A lot of those things can be fixed by regulation, not so much by legislation, or regulation could do some of that. But she's put it out there. Whether it'll make it through the gauntlet all the way through the Senate, kind of late in the game for that to happen. But she'll have a good ground to start with next session, should she return to Juneau with a bill, and people will help make her get it better.
So for listeners who are not familiar, Mark and Terry and Zaz, all of you, there is a technical process in terms of bringing a bill in the first year of a two-year.
This is a second year, though.
This is the second, right. So
everything dies.
Everything dies, right. Just make sure we're clear about that. So then you start off, but you can refile the same bill or substantially the same bill the next year. Mm-hmm. But its progress through the system gets lost.
Right. You got to start over. And it could get, I mean, as in the case of HB or of SB 63, the smoke-free workplace bill, it could get different committees, you know, totally different committees than it got the first 2 years. That's why that one's been vetted so much, because it's gotten different committees every time. So, you know, I think it's good that she's got the conversation going, and I think she's open to making her bill better by listening to stakeholders. And there's a lot of strong opinions as people find out as they're going to need it, because there are the chances of you providing care or needing care are practically 100% in this lifetime.
Okay. Well, let's turn to Zaz. Zaz, you've had some articles that you have worked on recently, one in particular right there in the center of Wasilla, a bit of excitement. Maybe you could summarize for listeners what happened and how people are figuring out why it happened.
Well, I can speak to the first part. This was on Wednesday, and anyone who was driving in downtown Wasilla / driving the Parks Highway north or south at a certain point in the afternoon and encountered what looked like a wreck but with way too many police cars. And what had happened was a woman had called 911 and said that this gentleman had been kidnapped, was being held at gunpoint for money or drugs, and was in her vehicle, which she described. It looks like a Dodge Charger in the pictures I've seen. I was told it was a Dodge. And so law enforcement descended on this vehicle. I think she had a pretty specific description of where it was. And, you know, there were Wasilla police, which is, you know, it's their jurisdiction, but Alaska State Troopers and their kind of SWAT-like unit, the CERT team, the guys who wear green. all kind of descended on this car, tried to pull it over, and it quote-unquote fled. So this was, I believe, the stop was at Wasilla Library, which is two city blocks from the Parks Highway. Mm. And so the car got as far and fast as it could in city traffic to the Parks Highway, tried to run a red light, and crashed into a couple cars. It sounds like there was only minor injuries from somebody in that particular car, but, you know, that's a fair amount of damage. And so, meanwhile, this kind of escort of law enforcement who were expecting a kidnapping surrounded the vehicle, got the occupants out at gunpoint. Any number of people, of course, immediately posted videos on social media. And it's, you know, it's pretty high drama stuff. What turned out, though, was that the gentleman who was supposed to be kidnapped was actually driving the car without a gun to his head to go somewhere, it sounds like. And so he was arrested. There was a gentleman in the car who had an outstanding warrant for a fairly low-level drug arrest. He was arrested, and there was a woman in the car as well who was not arrested. I don't know. The law enforcement weren't able to or couldn't tell me why it was that someone would report a kidnapping that wasn't, and what was really going on. What's the backstory there? We're still working on that.
Okay, well, that leaves us with a good something to think about as we move forward into the rest of the week. Mark, did you have any comments about this?
Just seems like such an odd and fantastic story. What, no follow-up information at all yet?
Nope.
Wouldn't the woman have some charges for false report of some sort?
Well, only if she intentionally falsely reported. I don't know what the circumstances were.
Okay. So there's a lot of what ifs and once again,
drama.
Truth is sometimes stranger, or the reality that we look at is sometimes stranger than the reality that we look at on our little screens. So that's what we have. Sas, do you have any other stories you'd like to reflect upon to top this one before we finish up today?
Perhaps fishermen in the wrong place?
Well, the sea cucumber caper in Southeast, that was a good one. But there, I'm working on a story that a number of other media have had already. I've been busy on breaking news this week, but there, for the first time in Alaska, a pathogen kind of nicknamed MOVI, it has a much longer name, that has been the subject of a lot of kind of concern over the last few years from one particular hunting group because it can spread to wild sheep and goats.
Right.
And, well, it has in the lower 48 from domestic animals. And so up here, this group wanted to preventatively start restricting domestic sheep and goats to protect doll sheep and mountain goats here from this pathogen, which now, as of Tuesday anyway, was detected in a very small number of doll sheep in the Talkeetnas, kind of behind Chickaloon, and a couple of mountain goats from the Kenai Peninsula. And so the kind of the crux is, did this pathogen come from farm animals, farm sheep and goats in those areas? Not a lot of big, I don't think there are any big sheep farms and no big goat farms. I think there may be a couple goat farms in Chickaloon, but little ones. And so the Alaska chapter of the Wild Sheep Foundation is arguing that, well, this obviously is an argument for restrictions, mandatory testing for this pathogen, and maybe they were calling for fencing requirements. Last year, the Board of Game tabled that, saying they didn't have authority over domestic animals. And so it's one of those, you know, scientific issues that we don't have enough information to say, it sounds like, with certainty, and I'm still reporting this today, but that the pathogens didn't come from domestic animals. But I think the indications are that the strain is different from that was found in animals earlier this year, farm animals earlier this year. But, of course, it gets politicized. So both sides are coming out saying, the farm viewer is saying, don't freak out. And the hunting group is saying, what a tragedy. All these animals appear to be healthy. And so this pathogen, it attacks the animal's lungs. It doesn't kill them, but it makes them vulnerable to pneumonia, which has led to die-off in bighorns in the lower 48.
Okay.
Meanwhile, we can't fish for kings in the Matanuska Valley.
Well, catch and release in some parts.
Yeah.
Okay.
And we'll see what happens there. I'm not sure how much latitude there is for change.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've reached that point where I say we've come to the end of another edition of Valley Edition. Amazing how quickly time flies. Well, I want to thank Mark Kelsey. Thank you for coming in today, Mark.
Always good to be here.
And I want to thank Terry Snyder for also making it into the studio.
Happy to do it, Mike.
And I want to thank Sas Hollander for calling in today with some fascinating stories. We'll be back next week for another edition. of Valley Edition.
You've been listening to Valley Edition, a weekly panel discussion on current issues in the Matsu Valley, moderated by Mike Malevsky. Valley Edition is a production of Radio Free Palmer, recorded at our studios in Palmer, Alaska. The views and opinions of hosts or guests do not necessarily represent those of Radio Free Palmer, this station, or its underwriters. If you have any comments or questions about this program, email manager@radiofreepalmer.org.